I want to take the opportunity to welcome you all to this committee meeting. We want to start by apologizing that you have postponed the meeting on Friday for today, precisely because we we didn't have enough members. So we're postponing to this day. This committee is not of alternate members. Today they are not here. You can see in the number. But at least we can proceed with our meeting. So I'll start by recognizing the apologies that we have received for this meeting. We have apologies from Mrs. Tongwane, Honorable Tongwane. She's not well. We have apology from Honorable Mandela, who is the whip of the other committee, the committee on oversight today. We have an apology from Minister, who's outside the country. And we have an apology from Honorable Sengwe, with alternate sitting in more than, I think, 4 or 5 committees. So he has never got time to attend the agricultural meeting. So I'm now going to, Mr. Ramaphosa and Mr. Pulemazi, Honorable Pulemazi and Ms. Honorable Ramaphosa will be joining us as we proceed to the meeting. Mr. Mabi is passing the University of State, and Mr. Ramaphosa is still having some commitment in the office to come join us just now. So Mr. Mag will join us during the day. Honorable members, this will be the longest ever meeting that we are going to have, because we are scheduled for this meeting the whole day until 19 hours. So I'm going to request the presenters just to save us from introductions and other things. Just go into the presentation. We have a long meeting today. And I'm now going to take opportunity to allow the briefing from the Auditor General of South Africa on the APP. KG, you're welcome in your team. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Honorable Members. Chair, we are quite a big team, as you can see. And can I just request quickly the team to introduce themselves? We are accompanied by our colleagues from the Western Cape responsible for the Marine Living Resource Fund, and the reason being in terms of doing the APP, the decision base is that we do it for the department. And because Marine Living Resource Fund is part of the is a program within DEF, we then requested them to accompany us so that they can then present the settlement relating or the portion relating to Marine Living Resource Fund, and also considering the interest in the fund as well. We thought, you know, it would help if they accompany us and assist us in that. My name is Lei Sing Tsau. I'm the business executive responsible for the DEF portfolio.
Good day, Honorable Chair. My name is Yvette Vergeto. I'm the manager responsible for the DEF audit.
Honorable Chair, my name is Fani Cook. I'm the senior manager on the DEF portfolio.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Holland. I'm responsible for the audit of Marine Living.
Good afternoon, and members of the committee. My name is Ariel Blau. I am the senior manager responsible for Marine Law.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if we go into the presentation, the slides up to slide 8, they deal with the background. And we've dealt with this background during the sessions that we've had last year. And for this reason, what we will be presenting today is in relation to the strategic benefit service delivery, precisely. Slide number 8 deals specifically with the outcome relating to the 2013-14 financial year. This is just for comparison reasons, so that when we deal with the usefulness, because this is what we are dealing with, and you recall from the session we had last year, we said that when we review the APP, we can deal with certain portions of usefulness, which is what we are presenting today. But reliability, because it deals with what has been reported, and which can only be done once service delivery took place and report has been presented for us to audit, then we test reliability of the information that is reported in the annual performance plan. So we are not there yet. We are now testing the SMART principles of the APP. And with that, Chair, I would like to hand over to Fani to just present to the committee the findings that we identified during this review, which we have discussed with management, and we have presented to the DG, even though we haven't had an opportunity to discuss them in detail. We have presented them to the DG, but have discussed them in detail with management. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. If you go to the slide where you start with the annual performance plan, 15-16, we talked about program 3, food security and agrarian reform. If we look at the strategic objectives, the indicators, and the targets for 15-16, we talk about number of hectares under utilization in communal areas cultivated for production. The target for 15-16 is 120,000 hectares. And this year, with the strategic plan APP, it's compulsory for the departments to attach Annex E. That's where the technical indicators descriptions are. And if we look at the Annex E on the target there, it says they undertake a 30% sample will be collected for each province at the end of the planting season. Which it's not measurable, an indicator is not verifiable, as it's not the whole population that they're going to do. So at the end of the year, it will not be possible to say that the population is measurable and verifiable. That's in program 3. If you look at the top there, 13% of the targets are not measurable, and 13% of the indicators are not verifiable. That's for program 3. We go to program 5. Forestry and natural resource management. Today we've got two issues. The first one is ensure conservation, protection, rehabilitation, and recovery of depleted and degraded natural resources. We talk about number of hectares. And then if you look at the target, it shows 250 hectares for the year. And if you look at Annex E, it says the number of hectares revitalized will be collected from the provincial departments as they comply with reports and procedures for cash and the LEMA funding program. There we also say it's not visible and indicators are not very viable because it doesn't specify the supporting documentation other than reports that will be collected from the provinces to ensure the target is measurable. If you look at on that one, the second one is also on the same as the one. It's the number of indicators, number of plantations certified in Forest Stewardship Council. Really, the target is one. And then in Annex E, they say the source is the service provider to evaluate data against agreed external standards. Not specific and measurable, and indicators not verifiable, as the annex does not specify the benefits from the service provider. And if you look, go to the top of the page there, we said 20% of the target is not measurable, 11% of the target is not specific, and 22% of the indicators is not verifiable. That is on the three programs that we've identified, and that's the three findings that we had during that. If we go to the next slide, that is in program 6, and I will hand over to my colleagues from Western Cape just to give insight into program 6.
Thank you, Fanny. With regard to program 6, Marine Nerving Resources Fund is in its strategic plan is four strategic objectives, or four strategic goals. And we've evaluated those goals and targets set out in the strategic plan and the following findings. Just bear in mind that we have communicated these findings to management. We still see discussing the impact of these findings for them. And from what we can see, that some of these findings we are able to predict, and we don't foresee any material impact on the audit report once these matters are corrected. For the first strategic objective that we identified was strategic goal 2, and here the target that we and the indicator that we identified that wasn't well defined. The indicator, the finding that we identified was for strategic goal 2.1, ensure this increased production and productivity in prioritized areas as well as value chains. The indicator was the number of aquaculture catalyst projects identified and listed under operation Batista supported, and the target was for operation Batista projects for phase one supported. Our finding is just that the measures are not well defined, in that the indicator for the annual performance plan read in conjunction with the target does not describe the type of support that's required in order to achieve the objective. Our next finding relates to strategic goal 3. And strategic goal 3.1, which is lead and coordinate government food security initiatives. The indicator was right allocated to 9 sectors. The target was develop sector-specific policies and allocate right to 9 fishing sectors. Here we found that based on our assessment, the indicator should measure compliance and or achievement on the FRAP framework. For strategic goal 4, sustained use of natural resources in the sector, for 4.1 and 4.1.2, which is food security and conservation protection and rehabilitation of depleted, degraded natural resources. The indicator was a plan to recover and maintain prioritized fish stocks. The target was recovery plans for 3 sectors, and for this target we found that the indicator was not well defined, as it should measure the achievement of the plan. For objective 4.1.2, which is the integrated fishery security, the target was 4,598 compliance and enforcement measures in 4 prioritized fishing sectors. Here we found that the target wasn't specific and that it did not define what the enforcement measures are. under the same objective 4.1, which and the same indicator, which is plan to recover and maintain prioritized feedstock. We found that this indicator was not verifiable, as the indicator should measure the achievement of the plan, and the target was recovery plans for three sectors.
Employee cost. And if you look at the
program 1, 391.81, they will show the number of staff in that program. If you look at program 2, program 2 and 5 is the biggest programs in the department. You can see the number of employees for program 2 is 1,510. Program 5, that's the forestries. There we talk about 2,580 staff members. So that is on the current rate, just on the compensation up there. And then goods and services was an increase of 5%. Go to the transfers and subsidies. There was a decrease of 8.4%. Departmental agencies was a decrease of 16.4%. And then if we go further down, there was increases in higher education institutions, foreign government, international organizations, public corporation, private enterprises, non-profit institutions is down, households is down with 77%. The total decrease is 8.7%. And if you go to the municipalities, the small amounts, the bigger amounts is the amounts that's paid to the provinces. That's the Lema project, the trust funds, and then the trust funds, that's the major amounts paid to the provinces on those funds. If you go to the next page, there's just a breakdown of the agencies and the accounts. The biggest amount there is the Agricultural Research Council, and there was a huge decrease from 921.46 to 69.28. And then the other small increases or decreases in the amounts from 14.15 to 15.16. And the last one is the payment of capital assets, capital goods. The major decrease was in machinery and equipment, is 43.34%. Biological assets is very small, although it's a 130% increase. And this year, Treasury said there should be budget cuts, and they actually said in which programs or which should be reduced, and by what amount of percentage it should be reduced, and that's taken up into this budget that was presented, yeah. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Auditor General. Do we have FFT among us? Are they here? Okay. Can you come in and present? We'll ask members, will load the questions, we'll ask them both. AG and FFT. Can you come and present?
Thank you.
on the plan of the Department of Death, as well as the annual performance plan. Let me introduce myself. I'm Nico Stadler, one of the commissioners, and then apology for our chairperson, acting chairperson, Bongani Kumalo, who are unable to make this meeting. There are just too many at this very moment. There's a big Salsa conference happening at this very moment in Gallagher Estate in Gauteng. Just our team today is Dr. Ramos Mabuku, who is the Director of Research, who will give the overview on the evolution of the agricultural and of agriculture and the contribution it makes to the economy. Then we have Mr. Khalid Dawood, who would then look at the departmental MPF analysis of that, as well as assessment of the strategic plan and annual performance plan. And there would also be two represent the FFC recommendations on these matters. And then information sharing, look at two studies that we've done that impact directly on agriculture. And then we'll conclude with some emerging issues. I don't think it's necessary to go to the next slide of the role and function of the FFC. You're very familiar with that, and let us go to the heart of the matter. Just again to point out that in this cycle of the work of the FFC, we have done two studies on the household vulnerability to climate change in two provinces, and these two studies, again, as I said, impact directly on matters of agriculture. So without further ado, let me hand over to Dr. Mabuku, who will in fact then look at the evolution of agriculture and its contribution to the economy.
Thank you, Commissioner. Morning, honorable members. Morning, Chair. I will take you through the evolution of agriculture and its contribution to the economy, just to set the scene to our analysis of the medium-term expenditure framework, as well as the strategic plans for the division. I think the main context is over a long time period. Agriculture has continued to be an important sector in the economy. But compared to previous eras, when I talk of eras, I'm talking in terms of centuries, compared to previous eras, its importance to the current South African economy is mainly in terms of indirect impacts or indirect contribution to the economy, as opposed to direct contributions. When you look at direct contributions for agriculture and the economy, you will notice that over a whole century, that contribution, direct contribution, has consistently been coming down to where it's now sitting at around 3% of overall output. Some measures put it even at 2.8-2.65%, depending on what measure you use as the denominator. And the decline is not unique to South Africa. This is a structural evolution that has taken place across the world, where the direct contribution of primary sectors in particular, agriculture and mining, has been on a consistent decline over centuries. Now, in terms of the indirect contribution, that's where you see the importance of the sector. Currently contributes around 10% of formal sector employment, which is a sizable chunk, and contributes an estimated 8% of total exports using 2010 measures, which is extremely important for net foreign exchange earnings for the economy. But again, as I said, the historical downward trend in the size of agriculture is something that needs to be at the back of our minds when we're making sector plans for primary sectors in particular. awareness, a plan ought to be more around what do we do differently from what we've been doing in the last 100 years, if you want to open the window that wide. So that's the nature of the challenge that we confront. Now, in terms of employment, job creation, which is a topical issue around the National Development Plan, what we notice is the same trend for agriculture. If you pick from 1962, agriculture was contributing around 1.8 million jobs to the economy. And in 2013, this had declined to 764,000 employees, total contribution to the economy. And a worrying trend, especially in the last 20, 30 odd years, is where you get a fourth quarter peak. In other words, for the first three quarters of a cycle, you'll get reductions in agriculture, only to get seasonal employment picking up in the last quarter when people going on holidays or when rains start coming. So there's also that seasonal component that needs to be taken into account when formulating plans on how to even out the employment growth in the sector, because you always find a spike in the last quarter or the holiday season when part-time jobs in agriculture tend to spike up, with people most likely looking for small earnings to keep their, to sustain their families during festive periods, etc. And that is what the actual employment figures for the sector are in fact picking up, and that's a trend which needs a direct intervention in there. The next slide comes to issues around affordability and food security type issues. When you look at those, the red bar there is food consumer price inflation, and the gray one is the economy-wide consumer price inflation. And you can see that agriculture has consistently had higher inflation compared to the rest of the economy. In other words, the output from the sector has been pushing up overall cost of living or affordability. And so issues of affordability for food, because now this is consumer price inflation, is talking about the cost to put food on the table. That has been above inflation. Although there is a slight petering out in 2014, where we saw a decline. But a lot of that is picking up the slack that we started seeing happening with international oil prices and international commodity prices, where there was a relative petering out rather than big structural changes to do with increased production or productivity in the sector as the driver for the slight decline in inflation. So the outlook for 2015 is that we're expecting there to be upward pressure on affordability from food. And this has mainly to do with the changes that we listened to when the Minister of Finance gave the budget, where there will be increments in the fuel levy and moves towards cost reflective electricity tariffs that are now very much in the pipeline. And those two constitute big cost item tickets in the agriculture or food consumer price inflation, thereby tainting a bit our 2015 expected outcome or in terms of affordability. Now moving to the big plans in the form of the National Development Plan, this envisages quite a big role for agriculture as one of the key levers for job creation and ensuring food security in the country. And it has identified four key objectives. Create 1 million jobs in agriculture, agro-processing, and related sectors by 2030. And for 2013, as I said, we are looking at 760,000 jobs thereabout. Now, how to sustainably create an extra 230,000 net jobs for the sector up to 2030 is the issue on the charge. Then increase investment in new agricultural technologies and research and development. Realize a food surplus with one-third being produced by small-scale farmers or households. And finally, create security of tenure for communal farmers, in particular women. Now what we see from the medium-term expenditure framework allocations that my colleague will speak to more in detail is that because of the lower than anticipated economic outlook, what we are seeing as the overarching environment for allocation is the issue of consolidation. What the issue of consolidation directly translates to is reductions in growth in expenditures across most of the board, with very few instances where there's going to be increases in expenditure over the medium-term expenditure framework. So now coming back to agriculture as a sector, it means if we are to start making any dent on those four imposing goals that I've spoken to, within the context of a consolidation environment, then we have to find a way of reducing non-core expenditure areas within the sector. We have to find ways of improving efficiency and ensuring that the impact of spending pressures on program delivery are somehow negotiated until the economy recovers. And this is quite a tall order to do, because it's one thing setting targets of a million jobs or increases in productivity. But when you think of how you move, in other words, how do you convert day-to-day activities into the outputs for 2030, there must be an understanding of the theory of change. What is that change? One of the major inputs within that theory of change is how much you put into the sector. And according to the public expenditures that we're talking about, our contribution in terms of public expenditures is going to be on the decline, which means outside of public expenditures is where the growth that we're anticipating from agriculture is going to be. So in terms of oversight, I would say before my colleague comes in, perhaps the oversight ought to focus on what these other things outside of public expenditures really are, because when you look in the MTF, there isn't much in terms of inputs or growth in expenditures that's expected to come from the fiscus, unless if something dramatic happens, then we can discuss what dramatic things can happen to the economic outlook to change the profile over the next 3 to 5 years. But if we take the current projections that we're on, the light chance isn't going to come from our public expenditures, but from other hangers outside of the public expenditure framework, which is where the eye for oversight really ought to focus on. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. So moving on to the medium-term expenditure analysis, the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, as you know, contains 6 programs. But when one comes to the focus over the medium term, we noticed that its focus is on food security creating jobs as well as increases its contribution to national GDP. And that's pretty much in line with what the National Development Plan expects from the sector going forward. Now, when we look at the spending and MTF budget by programs, and the AG has spoken to some extent to this, but when you look at the 2015 MTF, we see that it has been allocated 19.5 billion rand over the 3 years in the MTF period. However, when you break that down into real annual average over the 3 years, we see that it actually represents a 5.2% decline per annum. 5.2% decline per annum. And when one looks closely at the specific programs that have been hardest hit, we see that forestry is declining by 13.8% in real terms over the MTF period, followed by trade and market access, and then agricultural production. In terms of food security, which is something that we've identified as a key priority for the department, there's a 1% increase in real terms, and this is the only program that's increasing in real terms over the MTF period. Now, moving on to the next slide, we see that agricultural production, health and food safety, as well as food security and agrarian reform, those two programs combined makes up over 60% of total expenditure for the department over the MTF period. And as we can see this, that specifically food security, the share of the total funds that are being allocated to this program from the total government spending is increasing from 25% to 31%. So not only is it increasing in terms of growth per annum, it's also increasing in terms of the total share of the total budget that is being allocated to this particular program as well. Now, moving on to the next slide, looking at the breakdown per line item, we see that cabinet-approved reductions are evident for goods and services, transfers and subsidies, and to some extent compensation of employees as well. And with respect to transfers and subsidies, the reductions there are largely related to reductions in conditional grants, specifically the CASP grant that has not been spending optimally over in previous years. Now, when we look at the line item share of the total spending and MTF budget, that's the next slide. We see there that even though there's a real annual average decline in growth for compensation of employees and goods and services, when we look at the share of the total budget, the share of total budget for compensation of employees and goods and services is actually increasing with respect to the overall budget. So what that indicates is that reductions in compensation and goods and services would have been much more dramatic if the share had to remain the same. But because it's increasing, this increase is being absorbed by reductions in other areas, specifically, as we can see, in transfers and subsidies, as well as in payments for capital assets to some extent. Now, moving on to the next section, which looks at the analysis of the strategic performance plan and the annual performance plan of the department, what we try to do here is basically to look at the SVP and APP in the context of the 2013-14 financial statements and the annual report that the department tabled, and to see to what extent has the department actually implemented steps to address some of the concerns that have been raised or came out of the annual report. Now, when we looked at the spending performance, we noted that the department spent approximately 99% of its budget in 2012-13 as well as 2013-14. Now, although the underspending is quite minimal, the main reasons for the underspending are either related to delays in Department of Public Works processes, incomplete procurement processes, as well as transfer payments being withheld for underspending by the province. Now, when we look at the SPP and APP to see how how the department is expecting to address the problems or challenges relating to this under expenditure. We note there that the department intends to implement a stakeholder engagement strategy, and this could be a solution to addressing some of the blockages and coordination challenges that it expect that is currently currently experiencing with other sector departments such as Department of Public Works. Then also, if you look at ways that the department intends to strengthen support to provinces, we note there that the department is intending to implement intergovernmental relations forums in each province. Now, at this stage, it's unclear how the establishment of these forums is going to lead to more effective as well as more improved spending of transfer payments by provinces. Now, moving on to looking at the departmental performance relative to the SPP-APP, in 2013, the department spent 99% of its budget. However, achievement of targets was 75%. Now, despite this low ratio, what we find is that the number of indicators in 2015 is expected to increase by 40%, while budget has only risen by 4% when compared to 2013-14. And when we assess the two largest programs, that is agricultural production and food security, it doesn't suggest that targets have been scaled down or scaled down significantly to account for the minimal rise of the budget. And this therefore raises the question to what extent will the department be able to achieve its planned targets given its available resources. Now, Chairperson, the AGU is in a better position to comment on this, but essentially what we did here was to look at what were the audit queries raised by the AG in 2013-14 and how has the department implemented or identified indicators to actually monitor or track the audit queries that have been raised. Now, when we did an assessment of this, we find that the department has responded to a large extent in addressing some of the queries, although there is some queries that require a bit further clarity. For example, the audit committee raised the issue of, auditor general raised the issue of the audit committee not being in place in 2013-14. And there is no real indicator that we could identify that actually tracks how the department intends to implement or ensure that the audit committee is implemented in a functional way. Now, it could be that the department has resolved that in the 2015 financial year, in which case it should be reflected in the forthcoming annual report. However, if this is not the case, one needs to establish how we actually going to monitor the implementation of this particular audit query. Also, Chairperson, in terms of insufficient oversight of reporting and internal controls, which was raised by the AG, the department is implementing a three-year rolling strategic plan, which is identified at the CAC by the AG. However, it is unclear how the department expects to respond to queries, especially relating to implementing audit duties as prescribed by Treasury regulations. Moving on to the next slide, Chairperson, looking at the conditional grants which has been identified in an area that is going to be targeted for reductions. The department is a transferring agent for three conditional grants. And we will look at the assessment of those three conditional grants on the next slide. We see the on the right-hand side, all three conditional grants are experiencing a reduction in annual growth over the MTF period. With the CASP grant specifically being reduced by 6% on average over the MTF period. And when you look at the graph on the left-hand side, which looks at annual average spending between 2019 and 2012-2013, we see there that all three conditional grants have actually underspent over that period of time, with the cash grant spending only 90% of its total allocation over that period of time. The main reasons for the underspending 3% include poor planning, challenges with contractors, late changes to business plans, and weak and ineffective procurement processes. Now, 3% for conditional grants to be implemented optimally requires effective intergovernmental coordination. And there are a number of intergovernmental challenges that are currently being experienced in terms of implementing conditional grants. And here, Chairperson, I'll just identify a few of these challenges. One such challenge, for example, is when business plans are approved late. What this means is that projects commence late in the financial year, and invariably these projects end up being incomplete and funds unspent at the end of the financial year. Also, if there are any delays in the processing of land claims, this slows down the beneficiaries that can qualify for support from agricultural grants. A further area that is also important is municipalities play an important role in ensuring adequate land that is being zoned for agricultural activity in their special development plans, and also to protect existing zoning rights of emerging and micro farmers. And we've seen instances in certain provinces where there's been contestation between the zoning rights of particular agricultural areas and the demand for converting the agricultural areas into other more lucrative types of activities that will bring in much more revenue for municipalities. Now, besides establishing IGFR forums in each province, it is unclear how the department intends to address some of these intergovernmental practical challenges that relates to conditional grants. Chairperson, moving on to the recommendations, the commission submitted its submission for the 2015-16 Division of Revenue last year in May, and we made a number of recommendations specifically relating to the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. Now, we'll just go through the recommendations that we've made and highlight some of the issues with respect to those recommendations. The first recommendation, Chairperson, identified three areas that we thought requires attention. The first one, well, in the study that we conducted, we found that even though there's a framework in place for the conditional grants, quite often conditions in terms of that framework is not being made by the provinces, and there's been weak enforcement of those conditions by the department. So we've recommended that the department needs to ensure that they provide better oversight as well as enforce conditions in the grant framework. And those conditions are, if they are implemented, will improve and enhance accountability in the sector. The Commission also suggested that those standards should be established for provinces, as well as that five-year evaluations of conditional grants should be institutionalized. Now, in respect to that particular recommendation, the government has agreed with the recommendation and has said that the recommendation with respect to norms and standards should be implemented via DPME, and then the five-year evaluations will be institutionalized after the review of the CAPS conditional grant that has been finalized recently. Chairperson, there are a number of food security programs being implemented by different departments, sector departments. Excuse me. For example, agriculture implements food security programs, social development implements it. There's also the EPWP program as well as the school nutrition program. But what we have found is that quite often these programs operate in independence of each other. And there's significant space to actually reduce food security if these programs actually work together to improve its reach as well as effectiveness on a broader scale. And specifically, identified areas around joint planning as well as streamlining of procurement processes where better value for money can be achieved. This particular recommendation was not aligned to the Division of Revenue, so it wasn't responded to by government. However, the recommendation was sent to the sector department for response. Moving on to the next recommendation, the Commission sought clarity, specifically with regard to the legislative mandate and responsibilities for municipalities in relation to food security. And in this regard, within this context, the reason for this is that currently food security is not being seen as a mandate of municipalities and therefore cannot be funded. This was also not directly related to the Division of Revenue, but the recommendation was sent to the sector department for a formal response. And then the final recommendation that we made in our 2015-16 Division of Revenue was that terms of reference that had been established to set up a committee to review agricultural grants should be finalized without delay. And here we recommended that the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform be part of this committee to streamline any funding overlaps between the DAF and also the Department of Rural Development. The department, government responded to say that this is a priority and that work has begun on this. And according to what we've observed, there's been quite a number of developments in terms of implementing this particular recommendation during the past few months. Chairperson, as our commissioner has highlighted, we've just completed a two-year study looking at household vulnerability to climate change disasters, and we looked at two particular provinces, the Limpopo province as well as the Eastern Cape province. This project that was jointly done between the Commission and PAN or PAN in association was the University of Venda, University of Fort Hare, as well as the University of Cape Town. And in February, the Commission tabled the main report. There were four reports that were produced, and the main report was tabled in Parliament in February 2015. Now, the study essentially set out to achieve four main objectives. Number one, to assess the impact of future climate change on staple crops in rural South Africa. To use the household vulnerability tool to evaluate the vulnerability of rural households to natural disasters, to evaluate cost benefit of different adaptation options, and to make recommendations with respect to the financial and fiscal policy measures that can improve the resilience of households to disasters. It should be noted, Chairperson, that the gender dimension of household vulnerability was also considered in the study. Now, the study, just to give a summary of the study, essentially gave a microanalysis of the impact to climate change, as well as it provided a localized evidence of how certain stresses caused by climate change can affect rural areas. And then also, with respect to policy, it can improve policy targeting of vulnerable households. The Commission made two recommendations with respect to this particular study. The one recommendation was to develop a vulnerability index to isolate households that are vulnerable to climate change. That was the one recommendation. And the second recommendation was to ensure that any fiscal and financial interventions should take into account the potential vulnerabilities in rural communities as well as to support autonomous adaptation responses. With respect to this recommendation, the Commission suggested that the Department of Agriculture should support these strategies through improved access to inputs, markets, financial resources, as well as agricultural extension services and access to climate and weather forecast information. Now, Chairperson, there is a much more detailed presentation for the study, and if the committee wishes, we can come back and do a much more detailed presentation with respect to this particular study. moving on to some of the emerging issues which arose, which are just looking at the annual performance plan and the strategic performance plan, and just to set how it actually responds to some of the challenges in the sector as a whole. Now, with respect to providing sufficient support to emerging farmers, the development of the national policy on extension services is welcomed. However, when you look at the reach of extension services, is quite small in proportion to smallholders. And in 2012-2013, extension offices only reached 12% of smallholders. And therefore, there is a need for this new policy to improve its reach as well as its effectiveness in terms of its support that it provides smallholders. Also, Chairperson, there's a move towards establishing cooperatives in order to improve the purchasing power of smallholders. However, one needs to look at the viability of these cooperatives, especially in light of rising input costs as well as increased competition from subsidized produce from overseas countries. Now, when we look at the area of rural development, the department plans to develop 600,000 hectares of fallow land in communal areas, which is a welcome development. However, this should also be combined with other strategies in forestry as well as fisheries, which is called for in the National Development Plan, so that we diversify the sectors that we target to generate job creation in rural areas. Now, we know that there are significant constraints in rural areas, specifically around access to water as well as complementary infrastructure. So besides irrigation infrastructure, which the department intends to implement in the in its MTF period, it is unclear what other methods or other areas that the department is actually targeting in order to alleviate some of the structural constraints that is currently being experienced, and how it intends to coordinate its efforts with other sector departments. Now, Chairperson, just looking at the initiative to implement or to rather to grow, to plant, to extend the development of crops in communal areas, while this is welcome, it's an objective that overlaps with the Department of Rural Development. And as efforts to improve coordination, it will be important to just get a sense to what extent is the department working with the rural development in terms of implementing this particular objective. And then just finally moving on to the funding support for the sector. Now, while funding may be inadequate in some areas, it may be prudent for the sector to look beyond just the quantum of funding that is being received, but also to focus on the effectiveness with which funds are being spent, and also the implementation shortcomings that have previously been reported. And this message could be emphasized a bit more in the strategic and annual performance plan of the department. Chairperson, just some final concluding remarks with respect to the department and its its MTF budget. Just to re-emphasize, the National Development Plan sees the agricultural sector, forestry and fishery sectors as important for creating employment as well as growth and ensuring food security. Now, there has been pockets of progress, especially in fixed fisheries and also the development of the aquaculture industry in the fishery sector. But just to identify or to reiterate some of the areas that we feel require some attention, the MTF budget that is being allocated may not be aligned with the performance indicators for 2015. The department's oversight role with respect to provinces can be strengthened. There's also lack of clarity with respect to addressing some of the AG comments in the annual performance plan and the strategic performance plan. There's also a need for greater clarity on how smallholder farmers will be effectively supported, especially in terms of creating sustainable jobs in the sector and also to address some of the food security issues that we have identified previously. Chairperson, on that note, I hand over to our Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a fairly comprehensive presentation, and obviously fits nicely in with what the Auditor General has presented, so we would then welcome any comments and questions that, we may, what the members may have.
For the presentation. I'm now going to allow members to interact with the presentation. Questions for clarification. I've pleaded with the presenters that they must avoid introduction and other things. So I'm pleading with members. So ask questions and clarifications, avoid speeches. I know that you are politicians who must make speeches, but today let's zoom in on issues so that we are able to cover lots of space in a short time. Members, I'm inviting her to interact with you with the two presentations.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to everyone, and also thank you for the presentations. Chairperson, I'm having a question that I think maybe both the presentations can, or presenters can help me with. And it is an issue that I've been wondering about since last time. If we look at, and we will ask the questions later to the department on the targets and criteria that's used. But something that makes sense to me, and it maybe something that we need to measure at this portfolio, and it's on slide 10 from the FFSC Commission, the last bullet point where it says increase in food security, creating decent jobs in sectors, and increasing the contribution of these sectors to national GDP. If this portfolio really wants to measure the impact of the department, I think that's something that we need to put as a measurement over the past 5 years. If we take, you know, from every term, where did the department start off with in 2014, where did it end off in the end of the term 2019? Because to have all these little measurements that it's difficult to track and look at, I think the only measurement for us to see if a department had any impact would be those measurements. Because that is what the function of the department is, you know, looking at all the silly bits and pieces in between. That's all just fluff. It's something that we keep ourselves busy with on a daily basis, and we actually can't find the measurements in any case. So I would say, Chairperson, that we need to have a proper... my question would be, do we have this? I know we have the GDP section, but the food security... there's always people that differ. We keep ourselves open to NGOs and other organizations that's doing this, but I don't think there is someone in South Africa that really measures that. How do we bring this two then together? How do we link it? Because at the end of the day, I think the function of the department is to ensure that there's food security. And there was mention made by other departments that's also doing the same thing. Who is then supposed to take the lead role? Because I think in my own mind, agriculture must be the leading role player in this. The fact that social development and land reform and health and all kinds of other education and everyone plays a role in this. Can we get some clarity on this? Because it's something that I'm struggling with. Maybe I have it wrong, maybe that's not the main role and focus of the Department of Agriculture, but
So that's basically for both the presenters. Chairperson, another question that I want to ask is something that we will discuss, but I think it's important that we do get that case scenario of the climate change and disasters. I think it would be good for us to look at that so that we get that. And I think it is becoming more and more important that we do understand it. I don't think as agriculture we focus enough on that. There is definitely climate change happening. We speak to farmers on the ground, as I can tell you. I live on a farm, and I can see that the seasons are shifting. But we don't give enough, I think, as agriculture, maybe DG also for you for later. We don't spend enough time on that, and we need to prepare ourselves for that. So I think it would be good if we get that. And then, Chairperson, on the AAG's report, I've read the annexures in the back and the targets from that. I really don't know how you measure them. And I again looked at the different slides that you picked up and the different sections. But I would, as a person that needs to monitor spending or growth or progress, find it very difficult to monitor any of those, and I will mention them specifically. I know in a discussion a while ago there was a movement from measuring targets to measuring outcomes. So it's bringing me back to my first question. How do we measure outcomes? It's all good and well to say, and I've read it in the third quarter, it's attendance of meetings is a achievement, if for a better word. I don't know. We need to get a specific measurement tool. And what else can we take as a measurement tool than just having attendance of meetings as a measurement or an achievement? Thank you, Chair. I don't know what else to ask anymore, because it doesn't seem to me like we are moving towards something that I'm happy with.
Thank you, Chair. One question to the AG. Looking at the presentation, I realize that now in most cases it deals with issues of compliance. I just want to find out how far are we concerning the internal controls now. Are they still part of this most issues that are non-compliance? So I just want to find that issue, because we were informed previously that now the main problem with the department was the internal control now. I'm trying to find out if they still are part of the compliance as previously was, that is to AG. The FFC, I just want to find out on the issues of, because of this, a lot of information that you are giving us, I want to find out on the method of research, how do you come to that? Because these things are seem to be interactive with the people affected. Now, I just want to find out what is the method. The second issue is around how do you deal with the issues of doing things differently? Because the FSC understands the notion of doing things differently. But what is your approach to the department? Because you are an advisory body. You are hands-on. You have meetings, information sessions, or workshops, or seminars. How do you deal with that? Because we actually are looking forward to get that, especially from those who understand doing things differently. We need them as soon as yesterday. Thank you.
I know you have said agricultural employment has been declining, and you did make some references, because we are not existing in isolation from the world. We're part of the global village. Any experiences that you have checked land from other countries, so that we will look at that as South Africa. The other one will be under assessment of grants. I think that's a different presentation. Yes, the assessment of grants. It says main reason for understanding include poor planning. And it goes. But I think the key is poor planning. And I guess that is related to provinces, because they do get cars. And on our side, as national, what have you identified as not doing? Because for me, that is, this is our mind as national. What is it that we are not doing right in terms of the national department? The last one would be on cooperatives. You know, my view is that any economy and any change in a particular country, moving from whatever type of economy, when it gets to the new economy, the basis will be cooperatives. That's where it starts. And I think many countries have been boosted in relation of to establishing cooperatives. I'm not sure when we say we must look at the viability or non-viability of cooperatives. What is it that, because I know they are all over the country. Your view that you'll have to share with us would be what must we do so that they are viable, regardless that we have raised some recommendations at the end, but I think we must put an emphasis on this one, so that we know exactly from your angle, what is it that we're not doing right. I'm speaking as, when I say we, I'm speaking as a South African, not necessarily as a department or as a as a committee member, because all these things will be able to assist South Africa if we do them right.
What is the general and SSP? You can respond.
Madam Chair, thank you for these questions. I'll just do some preliminary remarks and then hand over to my team here. The first one is just, I think, Honourable Ramzwase asking what is the role of the FFC in the relationship with the department and how we interact. I think we need to be a bit cautious there. The FFC is not the expert on agriculture and how to plant and how to harvest. The focus is on intergovernment fiscal relations, and then the key story of how the national supports provinces, and also now what is the role of municipalities with respect to agriculture and food security. Obviously, detailed studies have been made in terms, say, of this climate change and how it impacts on agriculture. But we are not experts on every department on the substantive issues. There are other persons and institutions for that. Which raises the second question of what is the function of DAF. Honourable Stein has asked that, is it about food security? Now, food security in itself is a broad concept. There's food security from the production side, there's food security from the consumption side. And so the question needs to be said or asked is the department's role on the production side to say that there is enough? And some will say, yes, there's enough food, but it's the distribution of food which leads to the consumption lack of security. And so if you want to develop a measurement of how you assess the measurement of the department's success in food production, then clearly there would be measurements, and my colleagues would embroider on that. But again, the department is not the only player in this area, and what becomes more and more important is this relationship with rural development and land reform. Decisions made and policy outputs in rural reform regarding limits on size of land, the division of agricultural land, non-ownership of foreign, how is that impacting on the production of food? Is that going to have an impact? So it's not the only player in this. And so, again, coming through the presentation is, what is this coordination between the departments that is key to affect this food production security? There's so many other players in the consumption security. We're talking about education, early childhood development, social welfare. So one will actually see, so what is the link between the department and those departments that are looking at? And studies that we've done on food security from the consumption side to see that there is a huge array of measures, but none are coordinated, and that is a key issue. So, Ramos, if you could continue comment.
Now, coming to the question on agriculture employment that has been declining and any experiences that can be brought to bear from other countries for South Africa, what I could say, Honourable, is there is a growing number of experiences with how agriculture can be turned into an employment generator with varied experiences from all over the world. What we could do is we could share some of the experiences from various case studies that we have done and that are going to be discussed at the high-level policy conference in Maputo on the 26th and 27th of March under African policy leaders, where we're looking at a whole spectrum of case studies on the role that agriculture can play in implementation. So we could share those varied case studies. But what comes out of the case studies is that there is actually no magic bullet that one can come up with. A lot of country conditions are ultimately at the center of the type of results that you likely get. You can, for example, compare what experiences Zimbabwe and Brazil have undergone, almost exactly the same in terms of trying to boost jobs from agriculture, but with completely different outcomes because of the way the intervention was handled. And that speaks to specific country conditions in how one implements such large emotive type changes. So the overall story coming from the case studies is you pretty much get all kinds of experiences, but the ultimate explanator is your specific country conditions that cannot be mimicked by how other countries run through growing employment from agriculture. And I think for South Africa, what is quite significant is that we're talking about a long history here, where at one stage in the last two centuries, agriculture was contributing close on the 1 million jobs that we're talking about. And because of the structural realignment that took place in the economy, we are now sitting just over 760,000 jobs. So the big question, and this is one of the projects my colleague Alip Ye is doing, is how can we rediscover the old engines in agriculture? And we don't just do this for agriculture. We've seen the same structural realignments with mining. Mining has almost gone through the same process as agriculture. What is it with primary based sectors that leads them to have their share of the economy decline as time progresses? And some quite serious scholars have actually said maybe it's not such a bad thing because productivity in these sectors is actually their own worst enemy, that they jumped too fast in terms of producing enough to feed the country through technological improvements that take place way ahead of development of the rest of the economy. So what you're picking up is that the primary sectors have been ahead of the technology curve. And do you want to slow down that process and let the rest of the economy catch up with the innovations that have taken place, or you still want to continue pushing the barriers? So those questions are quite difficult to handle when you are sitting with people that are unemployed or on the street. Yet in terms of innovation that is taking place in your particular sector, you want that ultimately. That's why you are sending your children to school, that's why you are pumping money into education, and so that they become more and more productive. But the outcomes are, and I think that's the realm of policy making and oversight, where you are setting, which makes the job a challenge, the challenge that it is. So it's on how to get those balances right, which is quite important here. Now, in terms of assessment of granted cooperatives, I will ask Alip to come in, as well as a question on what can we recommend for national, where ultimately, if you pick on our recommendations, we're calling for explicit norms and standards to be set by national so that they can exercise effective oversight on provinces. Without norms and standards, it can be guesswork that they'll be doing. So ultimately, that's where we are heading towards.
So just to come in on the issue of cooperatives and the need and what can be done for cooperatives to be viable. Now, in South Africa, as we know, we've got a dual agricultural sector. We've got a commercial sector that's well established, and then we've got an emerging farming sector that is quite small in comparison to the established corporate sector, established commercial sector. Now, cooperatives as a vehicle is quite useful in bringing together individuals so that they can expand their purchasing power. So in other words, if you bring 10 people together, the ability to purchase or negotiate input costs or input reductions are significantly enhanced. However, there are other aspects of the cooperative model that should also be looked at. For example, when we bring these 10 individuals together, for example, to what extent are they able to cooperate in the establishment and the development of the venture and to make it sustainable? Now, there's been studies that have been conducted to assess some of the impacts of cooperatives and how they've actually functioned. And there's been a couple of things that have been identified which does highlight how these cooperatives can be improved in terms of effectiveness. The one thing is that the decision-making powers of individuals. So when individuals are brought together into a cooperative, they don't necessarily run the going concern. There could be someone else that is appointed on behalf of the individuals that make up the cooperative to run the cooperative for them on a commercial basis. And when you look at or you assess the situation, quite often there are instances where individuals, for example, don't have a lot of decision-making power in terms of what should actually take place or transpire within those cooperatives. So one way in terms of making them viable could be to, for example, improve the decision-making power in the cooperative as well. Secondly, quite often in the cooperative arrangement, there is not always space for individuals to actually farm on the land for individual basis. So in other words, while the land is owned as a cooperative in terms of the collective, they may not, for example, identify a portion of land where they can actually cultivate. Now, why is that a particular concern? Well, in many of these cooperatives, quite often what we find is that while there is an institutional arrangement that has formalized the arrangement between individuals to form a cooperative, in many instances there's very little activity that actually takes place on these farms. And there are a number of reasons for this. One reason is that there has just not been adequate management in as well as implementation of various programs on these cooperatives. Secondly, many of these members stay quite far away from these from the land which is actually purchased on DBR. So therefore it's very difficult to communicate between members and also between members as well as the management that is actually operating as well. And then finally, just to speak a bit about what needs to be done for national department to improve what they can do. The emphasis over here is really on identifying what are those blockages. And some of the areas that we've identified when we did the study last year was on the procurement process. And this is something that the National Department can work with the Chief Procurement Officer in terms of identifying what exactly are the key constraints within the provinces and how, and what implementation strategies can actually be implemented in order to actually turn that around?
Thank you, Chair. I will respond to the two questions. I think I summarized them to two. In terms of the target versus the outcome or the impact, if you look at at Annex E of the Department Stress Plan, they detail out what the impact is. And we might argue whether the impact is ideal or not, but it is in there. And I hear what the member is saying, because for instance, if you look at the irrigation one, where we're saying we are not sure how the department will meet its target. And if you go to page 106 of the strength plan, it indicates the purpose. What is it that they want to achieve? And amongst others, it says increase the contribution of irrigated agriculture and poverty alleviation. It says employment creation and skills development. It talks about contributing food security and improved socioeconomic conditions at household and community level, expansion of irrigation areas, identification as a strategic area. The truth of the matter is that the department can achieve what it is intended to in terms of irrigating however many hectares they have planned for the year. However, if there is no growth in terms of plantation, for argument's sake, for any reason, that there are dependencies, for instance, if there's no growth and there's no food or crops coming out, then the purpose is not achieved, however the target is achieved. So we will record that we have irrigated 80,000 hectares, however nothing came out to meet the intended purpose. So that is the concern. I suppose there's got to be some dependencies, because if we record that as an achievement, the following year it means we will do the same thing over and over again, yet we get the same outcome of not achieving the intended purpose. So we perhaps need to redirect, and I think that's the importance of indicating the impact so that we can then think of the dependencies and think of achieving the impact instead of the numbers and the targets. And I suppose, the department will then need to go back and reflect on the impact and way to achieve the impact instead of achieving the targets. In relation to compliance versus internal controls, share through you, I think members would recall that when we spoke about the three areas that we report on, we have indicated that in all these three areas, there must be specific controls in place and compliance as well. Because when you talk about any one area, financial, performance information, or compliance, the three areas of internal control apply, which is the leadership that must have policies and procedures in place, recruitment and all the rest of the things, financial management, procurement must be done in line with compliance. The same applies to service delivery. When we plan and we develop the threat plan, it needs to comply with certain rules and regulations. For instance, we spoke about the source document, that the source document indicated in the threat plan. We feel that it doesn't really indicate or doesn't correlate to the target, or it is not indicated that this non-compliance. So compliance is critical, and it has to be done in line with specific internal controls that are set. So yes, compliance goes hand in hand with the internal controls, because there's got to be proper monitoring and evaluation and ensuring that there is compliance in all the three areas that we test within an environment. So currently, the only compliance that we are looking at is in relation to the requirements of the National Treasury in terms of performance information, and we haven't looked at any other thing. When we test service delivery and reporting, there are certain compliance issues that we will be testing at the time, and we will be able to report on those on a regular basis. I hope I have responded to the questions accordingly.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was the response number. I assume that I'm not sure with FSC, but with AG, I know that this interaction has been happening with the department. So you expect that when the department is going to present, we'll see that that interaction, it must reflect the with the SSC. I'm not sure whether you have had that engagement outside here, but we want to welcome the the presentation, and even welcome the study that you said you have made, and we are going to invite you to come and present it to the committee when we have our third plan on the 19th April. We must just 17th to the 19th, the committee will be meeting, having the strategic plan. So we would want you to come and present that study. But my question on CAF, I think that there are a number of investigations that have been done that these conditional grants not been utilized for its purpose. So whether the SSC has intended to look into what is wrong with the grant itself, and how best it can be, the department can be assisted in making sure that the grant does intended purposes. For instance, department will usually say it's because it's in section Schedule 4, therefore it says that you cannot interfere in the work of the provinces. so it's making them difficult to get the correct data from provinces because of the schedule that they put this grant on. So, and I want you as a committee, has been that as long as I put my money, I must have interest where it goes. So, and it's the issue of the constitution of concurrent function. If we can just get clarity, or from me actually, from the chair here, so that we are able to know how to move forward with this senior cast.
Madam Chair, I think it's two issues here. The one is, can one get information and the national department get information? And secondly, what the FFC would do, a detailed study. Just as a lawyer, I can speak that the fact that agriculture is a concurrent function in Schedule 4 means that the national government has equal powers to the provinces on that area. And it may be active on that area. What and therefore legitimately it can provide conditional grants. But I think, as you rightly said, if it's conditional grants, the whole point of it, it comes from the national share of the equity from the revenue raised nationally, and that part of the condition is you provide data where it's effectively being used. So I can't see that there's any legal argument that one cannot get the information. And even implicitly, if the national government can intervene in the province, on what basis? The basis of monitoring and knowing what is happening. So I don't see that there should be a problem with respect of getting suitable information and finding out how such a grant is effectively implemented.
Yes, and on the issue of scheduling of a conditional grant, what we are noticing, I'll use experiences from other grants that were raising similar kinds of problem. What we are noticing is increased appetite for converting grants from ordinary conditional grants into indirect grants. We are seeing that a lot with water type grants, RHIG and RVIG type grants through human settlements. And over experience of 4 years, one striking outcome of converting grants into indirect grants is it's almost like parachuting a national department to actually do the delivery on the ground. And soon as its job is done, it parachutes out. And there's absolutely no capacity built at the grassroots. And thereby questioning sustainability of the interventions that has been made in the first place. So there's always that cautionary note that before national takes it upon itself to actually do delivery on behalf of the grassroots players, it has a full game plan or a full well-designed intervention. And another issue that we are questioning with this move is actually the capacity of national departments in particular to actually do this process. Certainly with water type grants, human settlement type grants, we do doubt the capacity of national to undertake nationalizing of that particular function, because there's so much involved in terms of time, capacity, human capacity, resources for a particular national department to be running with that at those disaggregated levels. So there are those issues around capacity of departments to actually run with nationalizing service delivery at local level, where the Commission does have doubts. We currently have a study on converting of conditional grants to indirect grants, where in May of this year we're going to table recommendations around that change in structure of conditional grants. And the essence of our findings from the case studies that we have actually used is to throw a cautionary note on that increasing trend of converting the normal grants into indirect grants, and instead focus on the oversight issues that the professor is talking about, and actually building capacity at the grassroots level as the area for intervention for national, rather than taking it upon itself to be a delivery agent.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll now go
going to get the department. Did you? On agricultural policy action plan, and DG, instead of dealing with DG,
agricultural policy action plan. Okay. The first slide, then go past that one. It's just the key acronyms in the document. The second slide just provides some background. Sure, you will know that for a while we have been making reference to APAP, that is a document that has been in the process since July 2013. And so it has been informed by the Agriculture Forestry and Fisheries Strategic Framework. This is a document that was known by many of us as the Integrated Growth and Development Plan for the sector that has been renamed, and it's modeled on the IPAC, the Industrial Policy Action Plan, and it consists of key action programs, commodities that we will focus on each year, and then some transversal indicators that cuts across, and I will speak to that later. And what it introduces into for the sector is an export-led import replacement, the word substitution should be deleted from that, agriculture strategy. And in the last bullet point, I'm sorry for that, it should be 2015, when the State of the Nation address, there were 9 priorities which the President identified, the second of which was the revitalization of the agriculture and agro-processing value chain, and APAC is the basis of that priority. Therefore, the revitalization of the sector and APAC does not belong, so to speak, to agriculture. We are not the only department who are going to make it happen, but we certainly are the lead department together with the Department of Rural Development. So like the presenters before me, the AG and the FFC making reference to the document that binds all of us, Vision 2030, the NDP, we also remind ourselves of the targets of the NDP, with this MTSS being the first 5 years of the implementation of the NDP. And I want to repeat those targets there, Chair, because this committee is familiar with the jobs, the hectares to be acquired, under production, smallholders, and food security. The next one is an interesting slide, because the NDP also begins to say this vision is possible. And that slide begins to talk about where these jobs will come from. And it makes assumptions on the land capability in the areas where most of the small-scale farmers find themselves, and it is also linked to particular commodities. So, for example, if the smallholder farmer were growing table grapes, and table grapes, the ratio, it creates two permanent jobs and one a seasonal job per hectare, and different commodities have there are certain formulas that are applicable. But what he says, I think the previous presenter also made reference to the shedding of jobs in the sector over many years, is a very ambitious target, but it is suggesting that most of the jobs will come from communal areas, just because of the practices there are more labor intensive. The next slide is also one which one finds in the National Development Plan, where the NDP goes on to say, builds this very strong argument about why agriculture is a growth sector. And it says that there are particular commodities, and the commodities that's in the top right-hand corner are the ones that are high-value crops, for which there is a demand and that will generate substantial revenue and which creates the most amount of jobs. I am told that among those in that quadrant on the right-hand side, macadamias and olives are the most labor-intensive. So given all of that information, issues around the contribution to food security, job creation, the growth potential, and the ability of the commodity to contribute to a more positive trade balance, we have selected a number of commodities that we will push in the first 5 years of the implementation of APAS. These are red meat, poultry, fruit and vegetables, wine, sugar, forestry, fisheries, aquaculture, and small-scale fishing schemes in particular, and biofuels, the production of sorghum, sugar beet, and sugar cane. And then I've made reference to that there are certain cross-cutting issues that will underpin how we will work in each of these commodities. And the one is Setsaphala, which is our transformative program to include smallholders and producers that were excluded. The climate smart issues, which the FFC has also made reference to. And I must say some of our responses that we've had, we have the drought and climate smart issues are right up there and highly respected. Trade, agribusiness and development and support. Biosecurity issues, which are essential for the sector, and then SIP, the SIP 11, which pertains to rural infrastructure and agro-processing, because it doesn't help having increasing production in areas, and you don't think of depots and roads and local mills and silos, etc. And of course, key to all of that, underpinning all of that, is research and innovation. So, Chair, I'm not going to go through the detail of that problem statement, because much of it is confirmed by the background which the FCC gave on the sector. And what we say didn't come through in their slide is the issue of market dominance and concentration. The fruit industry while it is one of the main drivers of the agriculture contribution to GDP, is one of the most untransformed sectors. 91 of the producers are your historical white commercial farmers, and it is the least untransformed. The milling industry is completely untransformed. You have your five big players who dictate what kind of grains will go into the mill. Rising input costs, there's been reference to it. There's been reference to the fuel levy hike that the Minister of Finance announced, and the user-based tariff for electricity. The unprotected sector, the decisions, policy decisions which we took years ago by abolishing the agricultural commodity boards, which in fact gave support to farmers and protected the industry, and therefore today we are sitting with this unprotected sector. The development of infrastructure, I think our infrastructure will be probably in the next 5 years we'll begin to see the change, but our infrastructure for pretty much before the intervention of the PICC represented the patterns in most developing countries to support colonial trade dominance. And then the integrity of an access to water sources. So it begins to talk just about our strategic response. I think given all of that problem statement, it's the strategic framework says, so what are we going to do about it? And I'm not going to talk to it. The one thing that it does say, and it concurs with the finding of the tax evaluation, that government has to move away from a project-based approach. Because individual little projects, small projects, is not going to bring us the growth. But one that drives agriculture more as the economic solution to the social challenges rather than the project-based approach. So if we go to the next slide, I'd like just to talk about those value chains and give honourable members, chair, an idea of the work that we have done. So we have have for each of the value chains, the commodities, we have a problem statement. And the problem statement for poultry says the consumption of white meat has expanded by 34%. Between 2009 and 2012, and is expected to expand at that rate. And this increased demand is supplemented through imports. And therefore there is a potential for decreasing our dependence on imports. And that will have to be supported by tariff reviews. And of course that in itself, increasing our own production and discouraging reliance on imports, is immediately threatened by the pressures that are on the country right now and on the poultry sector in the AGOA negotiation process, which I believe the committee focused on a few weeks ago. And they are the US is making demands to import, wants to capture 145,000 tons they want to export to us. And in fact, right now, our imports only average at about 50,000 tons. So if we allow the U.S. to import, to export, bring into our country 145,000 tons, effectively we are killing our poultry industry. So I think that is a threat that we are aware of. The high feed prices, we have dramatically increased our domestic soya production by over 300% since 1999, but it still doesn't meet with our response to our demand. Currently, the input cost accounts, like the feed cost, accounts for 60% of the cost of poultry producers. So then that's the problem statement for that sector. Then we look at what are the policy and project levers, government-wide, that support the poultry value chain. So we say there's the ITAC, the International Trade and Administration Commission, that can provide protection against the surge of low-cost imports. There's the IDC, which has invested in a soya crushing plant in Craddock. That plant is currently not operating at 100% because there isn't sufficient soya coming off off the land. There is the policy, the national policy of 75% local procurement, there's a figure of around 10 billion of food purchased by government departments, by government, over an MTF for hospitals, prisons, schools, etc. And if just a third of that is captured and sold, provided by smallholders, that would make a huge difference. Then we talk about what the risks are, and the risks are more or less the same for each of the commodities, the increase in energy prices. And electricity is key to the sector. And then the energy prices and the unstable energy supply, and the costs and the delays in conducting EIAs, and the increasing input costs. Chair, I've just been joined by the DG of Rural Development. I'll get a few minutes on the side. Good morning, dear. Good morning, DG. And then the next slide just shows graphically what we're talking about, how the dramatic increase in fuel, fertilizer, and animal feed costs over how it's particularly picked up since about 2000 and really at peaks in 2012. Then it begins to say, so what are we going to do about it? Now here are just a set of high-level actions. We're saying, firstly, CIP 11 needs to be focused on poultry production. We need increased infrastructure, investment in poultry houses, in yellow maize production and processing, in the establishment of hatcheries for parent stock. Then there's and that NAMC and ourselves will lead, they lead with our support, Rural Development and the Department of Economic the Economic Development Department. And then increased trade and procurement linkages between smallholder producers, commercial farmers, and feed companies. I think the FFC made reference earlier to the decline in the share of fiscus available for agriculture and the need to find other ways of funding this growth in agriculture. And I say that this APAC was developed in consultation with the sector. And already there are commitments for the private sector to come on board with us. But in this example, for example, we are thinking about there are a number of incentive schemes which DTI manages to promote investment. And one of the commitments that why we say DARF and DTI, because often DTI funds these big projects, very, very costly projects, bus building projects, rolling stock, etc. And how do they consider different size grants and different kinds of incentive schemes to talk to what we need in the sector? Land acquisition, and I'll show a slide now on the mapping. The space scientists and specialists from Rural Development government and DAP have been working together. And I've put together, maybe you must go to the, just click on two slides further to the map. What that slide begins to show, the blue little inverted triangle says that's where all the poultry abattoirs are. The pink circles indicate where the rural development nodes are, where are rural development projects. The amber one where our agro plants are. And so it begins to say, we think given the investments that we have made in poultry houses, but together with increasing the number of poultry houses and the tonnage we want to have in poultry, we're saying at the same time we have to put over the next 5 years to 2019, we have to put 238,000 hectares under soybean production. So the map on the left, on the right-hand side, begins to say where that can happen. There has been land that is most suitable for where there has been investment in soybean is in those areas stipulated there in KZN, and then the area in Free State and KZN in the area of Dannhauser and Newcastle. And then in terms of the agri-park model, it says it begins to make sense that the agri-park be concentrated around those areas where we believe that we can increase the soya production, the soya bean from the land, and also where we believe we should have the poultry industry. So the idea is that we begin to do the spatial planning so we can have these clusters of things happening in close proximity to each other. That in itself will begin to reduce the transport costs and the overhead that farmers have in that regard. If you just go back to the previous slide, Ito. Then we say that given the actions that we talked to about we talked also about support packages to ink poultry and soybean producers, a poultry research program, and then a national plan for pests and diseases for poultry. And we say there's a number of actions, and some we share, and I didn't include it, but what we have is a whole spreadsheet that talks to actions for every quarter on this revitalization and in each of the commodities. Tomorrow and for the next 4 days, our teams, cross-departmental teams, will be doing a mini-operation Pakisa. The everyone thinks of this issue of concurrency. We are not going to be able to succeed in this without the land. We are not going to succeed if we don't have water. We're not going to succeed if DTI doesn't lead on the trade issues, etc. But we are confident that we can bring all of that together. If we are able to do that, we say in the poultry value chain alone, we can add 14,481 jobs to the current 107,000 plus jobs into an increased tonnage of poultry, which is of 663,500 tons of white meat. Through the of putting 238,500 hectares under production for soybean, we can create an additional 14,173 jobs. If we do all of this, it will have the impact of increasing the contribution, the gross value of agriculture to GDP from 32.9 billion, an increase of 21.8% to 41.13% by 2019. The last statement says will increase the current levels of smallholders by 5%. Now, I know members will immediately say, how many smallholders are there? Now, at the time when we did this, we actually didn't know what the number was, but we knew that it could increase the number of producers. A study has just been completed. It was done by the NANC jointly with the South African Poultry Association and IDC, where they've taken the poultry value chain and they have a deepened poultry value chain study. So that information is available. So, Chair, we do this kind of analysis is available for each of the value chains. I don't know that the committee has the time for me to go through each of one, but I think, Chair, you can discuss me. The next few pages speak about red meat in the same way. It speaks about wheat in the same way. I think what's interesting about wheat on the wheat problem statement is the fact that we are, contrary to the around 202,000, 201 to 203, we were producing between 93% and 97% of our own wheat. Now we are importing 50% of our wheat. And therefore the conversation of change...
Don't jump the red meat.
Okay.
Start with the red meat.
Okay. All right, let me then go to the red meat. The red meat consumption has increased by 20% since the early 90s and is projected to increase by another 20% by 2023. We have consistently, the demand has outstripped the supply, and we have imported 10% of our red meat consumption over the past 10 years. And we're saying that we could rely less on imported frozen meat, and if we could improve market linkages with a vast herd in former homelands, and if 40% of the livestock herds are owned by farmers in communal areas. And therefore, we need interventions that will focus on commercializing the communal livestock. Again, the project levers that we have is the policies that we have around infrastructure development in communal areas. So, for example, I think it is a tax for Lima Letsima that assists with fencing in communal lands, as one example. Another that I know our minister and deputy minister is pushing is dipping tanks in each of the municipalities, etc. The 75% local procurement, the BEE codes to develop a local value chains, and what we're also going to be strengthening is an animal improvement policy. We've been making piecemeal changes to our animal improvement policy, and there are different improvement schemes that have been developed over years, and we think we're going to have an integrated and do an overall improvement plan, which we intend to conclude in the coming year. The risks are pretty similar to the risks faced by the poultry sector. It's increasing energy prices, input costs, and pests and diseases. I think we're well familiar with the work that we were required to do on F&D, on some of the other diseases that we talk about in this committee. So the actions here also, we start with infrastructure that we require increased investment in livestock production systems, the handling facilities, grazing pens, etc., etc., to develop the livestock value chains, it should have been chains in the not chains in communal areas. And NANC is managing that project, but it is funded, their work is funded by rural development ourselves and IDC. Then the next action is around increased livestock production in communal areas through expanding and improving support packages to livestock producers. I've made reference to the livestock improvement plan, the KYD program that we talk about here at times pertains to the identification of each of the animals, the tags, the tagging of animals, the recording, performance testing, and breeding, and where the scientific work of that program is done by the ARC, and it is our role to be able to export it to more than, I think it's around 7,000 smallholders that are benefiting from that now. To expand the training of extension officers to support smallholder farmers in red meat production. We have said in the revitalization, in the document that was approved by Cabinet Mokotla, we have said in there, we have a commitment to deploy a cadre of well-trained extension officers. And more our thinking is, if we are talking around these value of our focus going forward is on the value chain, James. We cannot be comfortable just with having extension officers as generalists, but we should have people who are specialists in the different areas. Land acquisition, the same story. Our maps are able to show where the land, the portions of land are that have high agricultural potential. It is able to show which land has grazing capability. And therefore, the work that we will do together with rural development is for rural, as rural development acquires the 2 million hectares of land for expanding red meat production, they will acquire the land that is suitable according to the science that we have available for grazing. And at the same time, it is DARF who has to say who should be getting that land. Because we have a farmer register. And that farmer register must be able to say, this farmer started with 20 herd of cattle. So many years later, that herd is now at 80, and it's set to be 200 in that amount of time. Therefore, this is the person who should get a bigger piece of land whose failure to do so means he or she will be overgrazing the land that they have at their disposal. The review and assessment of the vet and animal health care strategies in according to OIE requirements, so that we don't every year, January, before there's an OIE audit, scramble around, but that work that we've got to do to implement with regard to retaining our foot and mouth and our disease-free status, that is ongoing. It's integrated in our program. Strengthening farmer organizations in communal areas. This certainly is not a strength of ours, I don't think that as a national department we can claim competence in that. We can claim that we have a hand in the establishment of our soup, the Unity Forum, but we are not going to achieve this on our own. So that's a new Unity Group. We've never had that target set out there. And then the National Livestock Research and Development Program, again, like in poultry, there's a whole program that pertaining to breeding, disease and pest control, and lowering of input costs. And I will notice just in two of the valued commodities, there's a research program. We notice in the presentation, I think it's the AGIS presentation, where it also showed that it's the AS transfer to the ARC that was reduced by 8.6%. So that is worrying, the funds to invest in research is decreasing, but that certainly is a dependency. So, again, we say, if we get all of these things right. And if we get all of the support, all conditions being favorable, we can, the impact of the red meat value chain is, we can improve income generation schemes through improved market access for smallholders. We can achieve improved herd structure and an increase in the calving percentage in communal areas to sustainably supply markets and improve land availability and accessibility of food. I think by the end of next week we'll be able to put figures to it, because improve is not, I don't think improve is measurable. We've got the baseline now, but we must be able to put an end target to it. The creation of targeting the creation of 75,400 plus jobs, and we say how much of them will be in beef and how much in mutton, from the expanded production of 286,200 tons. Increasing the contribution of red meat to the agriculture GDP from 12% to 15% by 2015, and increasing the number of smallholder producers by 5%. We don't have a value, but that is also the baseline that we want to establish. So you'll see, I think earlier there was a comment about what are the impacts that we want to hold this department responsible for. So we're putting those impacts there also of what we want to achieve in the long term. Chair, shall I go to all of the others? Okay, so I started talking about wheat there, Chair. An interesting one is that the DTI is investing in small mills, which I believe will cut down on the transaction costs for the smallholder producers, and that in itself is a very transformative action. The inflected impact is there too. An interesting, if you look at that map there, Chair, those green areas says those are the places where wheat can grow. But if you grow wheat, for example, in the Free State, where it's the light green, you're only going to get between 1.5 and 2.5 tons per hectare. But the best land for growing wheat you'll find in the Western Cape, where you have the dark green, because there the yield will be 3.5 and 4.3 per hectare. So I think that is the level of science that will also inform our targeting eventually. I've spoken to fruit and nuts are the drivers. Fruit, nuts, wine. When you look at agriculture's contribution to GDP, it is those three commodities. Huge fruits and vegetables are hugely labor intensive, and the new jobs that can be created in the sector is phenomenal. We speak about wine as well, a fairly well developed sector. We speak about biofuels and forestry. I want to go to the just on aquaculture, Chair, the slide 29, there's, at some point I think we would like to, if we haven't done it yet, Mr. Manya, we should do a presentation just on aquaculture. I've noted the AG's comments on aquaculture has a detailed plan that was developed in Pakistan. I think the way that we must improve our annex to E is to say that we will deliver on aquaculture by way according to that operation plan, because it's subject to weekly monitoring and monthly reporting. But our research also says if we do what it identifies a number of obstacles to this very new sector, aquaculture, go to the next slide, and through the 23 catalyst projects that we have selected, we are hoping to learn how to address and direct those obstacles to the new industry. And if we get all of that right, we say that by 2019, agriculture, where its contribution to GDP now is 0.4 billion. It would, by 2019, rise to 3 billion, where 15,000 decent jobs can be created, and we will grow the fish consumption in South Africa from the current 8 kilograms per capita to 19 kilograms per capita. Although that will also be a huge social movement, because we are not a high fish eating country. So it's not, and again, it's not something that we will get right on our own. It's something that arts and culture, and I think it needs quite a wide mobilization strategy. So Chair, the next two slides, slides 31 to 32, begins to talk about the things that we are focusing on still now, and that we will also be working on in the next few days to be at a different place of readiness on the 1st of April. I've spoken about the spatial planning, but this communication strategy is quite important, and because there's a paradigm shift that is required. The concerns that this committee has shared around how we interact with provinces, how the way in which farmers have been supported, not only how government has done it, but also what farmers have begun to expect. It requires a paradigm shift, and therefore there's a communication strategy. We've talked about the institutionalization. For example, in the MTSS, there are the district land committees, which rural development is responsible for. And so what we have done, that is being driven by it's been chaired by the provincial forums, it's been chaired by the HODs for agriculture and rural development. And each of the HODs is supported by a DDG from rural development and land reform and ourselves. And we believe that is the way in which we'll be able to get those district and municipal-based agriculture and rural development focus. And again, that's part of the culture change as well, but that is an initiative that is underway already. It's not something we intend to start. I talked about the production targets, the land acquisition, about SIP. We as mentioned, training, about training our extensionists to become specialists. And then I think another one, important sentence there, is to develop creative models for attracting new entrants, young people and women in particular. I've spoken to R&D. Something that the committee will be interested in, we've done quite a bit of work on an integrated funding model, because we've estimated that between ourselves, the rural development and the land bank, there's about $34 billion available to the sector, and an integrated funding model is being developed. And on this spreadsheet, you'll see. And I think the one of the slides earlier talked about the work that we're doing in that regard. The secondary funding that is available, because there are lots of other departments that are active in agriculture. One example, Chair, is the food and nutrition security policy that was approved in 2013 makes the institutional arrangements, makes provision for an interdepartmental food and nutrition security technical forum. And that is the place where we do that integration. That is the place where we are monitoring the contributions of other departments. We have a deal with household food security and with production. It's something that we have to strengthen. The point I want to make is that there is a structure that is in place to do that coordination. And just on external funding to support what the FFC said earlier, there are funding sources. There's the MassMart Supplier Development Fund. There's the AXCRI Development Fund. There CADAC investment plan once that is improved. The commodity groups, the trusts, they have funds available. We are in the process of unlocking 200 million from the maize board for research that we need. So I think those are some of the creative ways that we can bring more money to the sector. Take-off agreements, some work is underway there as well. Tiger Brands have said to us, we have a shortage of sunflower oil. We've got to import sunflower oil. Why should they be importing sunflower oil? They're importing a substantial amount of tomato extract for the cool baked beans we all eat. Why should that happen when we can produce the tomato extract? And then, of course, we've made reference to that. So, the last slide, really, Chair, says, all of these things, the overall, what will the impact be? This is spatial planning. I'll go past that one. There's the last slide. Isn't there a last page? Yeah. Aspiration. So if we put together all of the value chain, and somehow, for now, we put it up here, but we also want to put it in brackets, in italics, until we finish our little paquita. And we say, APAC could increase the number of smallholder producers from 164,000 in 2012 to 400,500 by 2019. All things being equal, we can increase the value of agriculture, forestry and fisheries from 42.5 billion in 2012 to 48.9 billion in 2019. Or a 2% real growth. We can increase the value of net exports from an annual average of 5.1 billion in 2012 to 5.8 billion in 2019, a 2% real growth per annum. We can decrease the value of fertilizer machinery imports at an annual average of 9.6 billion to 4.7 billion. That is if we bring, and I think I've explained that just in the APAC process, because we'll be managing the value chain very differently. Reduction in the share of households experiencing hunger sometimes, often or always. Now, that group is at 10% in 2012, and we say all things being equal, making available affordable food locally, we'll be able to decrease that by 8%. And that's a measurement that is done by SA through the General Household Survey. And then increase the number of jobs in agriculture from 660,000 in 2012 to 822,500. An additional 1,662,500 jobs, and so we say we will be able to create 1 million jobs by 2050. So Chair, the key issue is moving away from a project-based approach to a value chain approach, doing it in an integrated way, but it's going to take a huge paradigm shift and working together with different departments. Thank you.
Thank you, DG. Members, I want the DGs now to zoom into the APT, which will tell us whether the target does stick to what you are saying with this framework. And then from there we'll then interact with the report. Let me welcome the DG of Rural Development, Mr. Mdu, and the Deputy Minister, you're welcome. DG for Rural Development. Do you want to say something? Okay. Thank you very much. DG, you can now zoom into the HPP and strategic plan of the department so that you can then see that correlation and you can have water, DG, in the meantime.
provides an overview. We talk about the goals and objectives as indicated there. The overview is familiar. It's the compliance statement. So we say we have complied and we've with all of the requirements. And in the next slide, we speak about the alignment and the policy form in the sector. In slide 5, we talk about the operational environment, which is known to the committee, but I think that's pertinent to how we plan and what it is we can do. And I think it's important to note that agriculture is a concurrent function and forestry and fisheries are national functions. And there's just in terms of HR, it talks to what some of our priorities are. And again, you'll be keen to see we've pulled through the priority in our HR strategy also refers to the employment of youth in the agriculture, forestries and fisheries sector. That becomes part of a feature of our HR strategy and the transformation of our workforce in terms of gender, the kinds of professions that we need to take our strategy forward and our focus on these commodities. And something that we have to do, that we want to conclude in the next year, is the review of the organizational structure. Right now, the organization is structured according to these branches. Various administrative branches. It's agricultural production, health and food safety, food security and agrarian reform. And therefore, our budgets are structured like that too. But I think what we will do seriously the ministry will lead us in that, is that they believe we have to align the department to those three priorities: food security, GDP, and growing of jobs. That we believe that our strategic objectives are the right ones, but they span across all of the departments as they are now. But I'll come back to that point. I think the issue of the aging workforce and the aging sector is important. Chair, I'm not going to focus on the vision, mission, and values. There are a few changes to the wording, but it basically carries through the theme of food security, job creation, and economic growth and the transformation of the sector. Slide 8 speaks to the policy and the legislative mandate, which informs our strategic plan and our APD. The next few slides talks about the key issues. Now, in many ways, this talks about the problem statement for the sector. And I think dear honourable members will see the overlaps between what we have stating as the problem statement and that which the Finance and Fiscal Commission stated. The underutilized arable land that has to be put into production, the movement of goods and people that have increased the need for us to anticipate and to prevent diseases, growing food insecurity, market access for I think that means yes, it does have one. It should be former homeland areas. Thank you. That's an oversight. the smallholder farmers, export estimations, the talk about the fish stock, the globally fish stocks are depleting, to promote transformation in the sector, the declining hardwood and softwood plantations, the shortage of timber products, which is reflected in the forestry products and wood products that we are importing right now. I think most of our pulp for paper is imported, and input costs, etc. The next slide, I think, is, I'm not going to go through that, it says we, the whole process leading to this plan. I think the issues that we, that brings us here today are our strategic objectives. So we've got the four strategic goals. They've not changed from since last year. We might have changed a word here and there, but the emphasis hasn't changed. The first strategic goal focuses on an effective and efficient governance and administration. The second goal on increasing production, employment, and growth in the sector. Section goal three, about an enabling environment for food security and sector transformation. This is our goal around transformation. And the third one is on sustainable use of natural resources in the sector. So those are our focus areas, really. In each of the strategic goals, there are strategic objectives. In the first one, on administration, there's an objective about compliance with statutory requirements and good governance practices. The second one is about our interaction with stakeholders. The third, about the strengthening of our mechanisms for integrated policy planning, monitoring, and evaluation in the sector. I mean, the discussions earlier, Chair, about how the IGR matters. I mean, we have institutionalized MINTEC structures where we do planning and reporting with, at a technical level, with HODs of agriculture, which reports to eventually the political structure, which is the MINMEC. So those are, and there are various technical committees that are the legs of those structures. The second strategic goal two, there one begins to see the reflection on APAC, is where our objective is to increase production and productivity in priority areas and value chains. The effective management of biosecurity and related sector risks and market access, support for market access and processing of products in our sector. In terms of our food security and transformation of the sector, where we, our work, we believe, is around leading and coordinating government support for around food security initiatives. I've made reference to the forums that we coordinate to enhance the delivery capacity of the sector and to strengthen planning and implementation for the comprehensive support program. On natural resources, this would refer both to the work we do in forestry and fisheries, and firstly it's around conservation, protection, rehabilitation, and recovery of depleted stocks and degraded natural resources. And the second one pertains to our adaptation and mitigation to climate change through the effective implementation of prescribed frameworks. The next one, Chair, is just explains what the strategic goals mean, and I'm not going to go into that. I think, Chair, I'd like to focus on the slides where I have the actual APP, the table. The next few slides just talks about what each of those, for each of the programs, I said the first program pertains to administration. So I'm on page 14, what we will focus on under administration, risk management, oversight, HR, how we, financial management, policy frameworks, etc. Program 2, Ms. Chedwick, much of this is reflected, the detail is reflected in the actual APP. So I'm almost want to say I don't want to talk on this, because it's going to feel like a repetition if it comes to the next few slides. The next one is still part of Program 1. Slide 16 speaks about the animal, the production issues, what we will do, which, and this is what we'll do over 5 years, what we'll do around disease management and the conservation of some of our resources. Slide 17 speaks about the food and nutrition security policy, and so you see there the sub-bullet point 3, where we say over the next 5 years, we will support 80,000 producers, we will cultivate 600,000 hectares in communal areas, and in the next slide, we begin to talk about smallholders, improving access to markets, about a new thing that we've introduced are these fruit and agriculture value chain networks. Those are the places where we sit with our sector partners, and the fruit and aquaculture value chain has been established already. They are working. And Program 5 speaks to the particular work that we will be doing in in forestry and in fisheries. Fisheries we speak to on page 20. I'll come back to that slide, Chair. But this is, I think, all of the jobs that we see ourselves creating. I don't see a total here, but the number of jobs to be created, I mean, it's spread through the document, and we thought we should just bring it together on one page. So column 1 pertains to the number of jobs that we will be creating in through the forestry, through land care, through the fisheries program, CASP, and ELIMA, LETSIMA. If one of the folks can just add up what the number is there. Chair, I'd like to go to the annual performance plan, because I think this is where honourable members want to see the relationship between what I talked to on APAC and what we're doing here. Chair, what I've done here, our APP is organized according to the program. Administration, the program 1, program 2, program 3. What I've done in this document is to take the strategic objective and just bring it all together under one. You can see what the work is we're doing under food security, etc., just to make the reading easier. So this information that's on this slide here, on slide 23, can be found on pages 25 and 26 of our... You don't have it in your document.
Okay. All right. Let's
Thank you. So the information on page 23 can be found. Can be found on page 25 and 26 of APP. It refers to our targets for risk management, fraud prevention, and the internal audit action plan implemented. And this is just to give assurance. One of the things that was raised by the Finance and Fiscal Commission, I think that AGA had a chance to respond to it, was the finding that we had in 2013-14 that we did not have a strategic risk register and did not have an internal audit plan or internal audit committee functioning. This slide pertains, shows the, in fact, it has been corrected and it's also institutionalized in this slide. The next slide, slide 24, speaks about our human resource plan, which is implemented. It says in the first column, what is the audited baseline? The audited baseline is this integrated human resource management plan, that the reports that have been submitted to DPSA. And so every year we are required to develop to review our HR plan and implement that plan and report to DPSA. We have put as a target their numbers to finalize misconduct cases. This is a new target that we've just introduced. It's a target, I think it's the foresight action plan, and it is a target which we introduced in the current financial year, which ends next week. Then we will have a baseline. We don't have a baseline for that. Nor do we have a baseline for a business continuity plan, because we haven't had one before. The next indicator on page 25 of the slide, and can be found on page 27 of our APP, is an unqualified audit report. We have retained the unqualified audit report for financial statements. And the Integrated Development Finance Framework Chairperson, we don't have a baseline, and you'll remember on our APAC presentation, we make reference to that Integrated Development Finance Framework. The number of bills tabled in cabinet, we have stated that for each of the years of the MTF, except the last, we will table 3 bills. Our baseline there is that in the previous financial year, 2013-14, there was just one bill, amendment bill, that was passed. Slide 26 refers also, will also be found on page 27 of our APP. It talks to the stakeholder engagement strategy. We'll have to refocus this strategy to the observations that are made on APAC, where we said we're going to need a robust communication strategy to forge that paradigm shift. Intergovernmental strategy is very clear, that some of the oversight structures are asking us about it, that we must do something to refine and make very apparent the integrated IGR structures which we have. So there's something that we will institutionalize a lot more stronger, and is on communication is also a target. Then we have targets just on compliance with our the APP on non-financial performance information. And then we will see APAC chair on page, the third target on page, indicator on page 27. Obviously, we don't have audited baseline for APAC, but we will present an annual implementation, annual report of the implementation of APAS. And that report will be tabled to Cabinet. We will be required to do that because, as I said earlier, that APAS is the programmatic response to priority two, revitalization of agriculture and agro-processing, and we are required to provide quarterly reports to Cabinet on that. And I also said earlier that we have based APAS on the IPAS model, and IPAS has a formal report, has a published annual report every year. And I think that one of the I speak under correction, but I think one of the findings of the AG was that they thought that our APAC target wasn't smart, but I think we can tighten that one up by making reference to the actual implementation plan of APAC. The next target is also management stuff, it's governance structure over our entities, the sector information system. We actually did make through some very interesting reports. Data on sector data, every quarter they bring out a report on exports and imports, on growth in the sector. There's also a report on the food index or food, the cost of the food basket. There's also a section of our budget that is provided for research, which is referred to on slide 29. So we make sure that our policy is aligned. That I think in the past we've had a situation where our research policy was almost sitting in a corner, to be pie in the sky stuff, and that it's not aligned. And the commitment that we have to make is to ensure that the little funds we have that's aligned to the research priority under APAC. The other agreement that we also have is, while we cannot dictate to provinces and while we cannot dictate what research focus our entities take on, because lots of that research is funded by grants that come with funds, but what we will make sure is to know what the research and the agendas are, so we don't have unnecessary duplication. The project system, front end of the project management system design, we are already beginning to do that share. For example, provinces have given us their business plans for the year. How are they going to be implementing tax and Lima Lexima? As we sit here, our colleagues have begun to map, but they must provide us with the coordinates. They must provide us with the ID numbers. They must provide us with the names of the extension officers working in various areas. So that is being electronically plotted, so that we can, before we transfer money to a province, we are able to say we have the coordinates of each of the project locations where work will happen, so we don't discover at the end of the financial year that the coordinates are in the sea. And we have checked the ID numbers of the beneficiaries or people working in those locations against the Home Affairs database to make sure that they are not invalid ID numbers. The issue of the ID numbers belonging to people who may be dead, I think that will still come up. Because if this land belonged to my husband who has died and the land has not been transferred into my name, if it requires the name of the landholder, I think there will be instances where that happens, but we will make sure that it can be explained. So again, I'm just trying to give assurance that we're trying to start off at a different place in terms of being able to monitor and holding provinces accountable. Now we come to the that all of the previous ones were more the administrative and compliance and governance issues. Here we talk about the next, on this slide, all of the indicators that will enhance production, employment, and economic growth in the sector. The first one is about the animal improvement scheme. So the first one, KYD, that we will do for the coming year is for the livestock industry, and there will also be one for poultry, which immediately talks to two of the commodities in our value chain. There are planting improvement schemes, which is seeds and fruit, and the fruit also begins to talk to one of our value chains. For aquaculture, previously we just had fish farms. Now we are saying the four Operation Paquita projects that will be supported, and I've talked to that earlier about how we can improve the NHGE that the AG reported on. The research is another component. We're not going to take aquaculture forward or any of the if we don't do further research. And this research target in aquaculture, the number of aquaculture research projects conducted, can be found on page 70 of our APP. The next one on page 22 refers to the animal disease risk surveillance that is conducted, will be conducted. Our baseline WASP survey is on the National Pig Peak Survey and on avian influenza, and we will do one on avian influenza. I'm not sure what this PPRR. Okay. And so there we mentioned what the area where we'll do the surveillance. Disease risk surveillance, you see that fruit fly poses an enormous risk to our fruit industry. And until we get that under control, it's important that we continue to conduct that exotic fly risk survey. And of course, immediately the results that come out of that needs to inform our communications and stakeholder relations strategy, because just of what the research shows us. In terms of the further issues on biosecurity, it is around the number of regulatory and compliance interventions that we are doing. We are the audited baseline is provided, and it's saying in the proper, and they will always pertain to the quarantine area, inspections, surveillance, and testing, where these are services which we provide as well, and which will result in an audit report. A new target is the number of veterinary graduates deployed to rural communities. We are very hopeful that within the next few months the regulations will be promulgated. They are now out for publication, and that will enable us to deploy these vets. And then the number of primary health care clinics. I think our baseline, it wasn't for this year, it what we had achieved in a previous financial year, it was 27 that we had delivered, and our target for the current financial, or the new financial year, is 18 primary healthcare clinics. So again, this relates to the red meat value chain. So too does the veterinary strategy, and making sure that it's enabling legislation and finance over the years to support the animal disease management plan which we intend developing. Then a another set of indicators that can be found on page 54 of our AEPP that refers to the number of the goal, the indicator of creating an enabling environment for smallholders to access markets, and the numbers of smallholders that we believe we will be able to provide access to are very modest. And I think it's because we are, again, a national department, and because of the way we deal with concurrency, I think that the Finance and Fiscal Commission has made the comment about we can't parachute into the provinces and do things over and above which provinces does. But this would be certain a few of the agri-DEE stuff that we will be doing and other examples. Then the value chains I've spoken to, these value chain roundtables are definitely in support why we'll have the overall stakeholder structure with the CEO forum and other structures in the sector. We have to have these conversation tables and networking sessions for each of the sectors. In fact, we have made a proposal that the next value chain that must be established is a grain value chain that you can bring the wheat producers and maize producers and the millers into one room. In terms of promoting trade, so we have a trade and competitiveness development plan. So it's about implementing that. And we have not had the market opportunity profile report. We've not stated there's a given an audited baseline, because that in itself was not a target. Now, this could be one of the areas, I think it is the FSC that said we have more targets than we've had last year. But this is a unit of work that this branch has done. We have, for example, done country profiles on 50 countries, 54 countries so far. So, but we're putting out here work that we are doing that is valuable to the sector, so it's not an additional thing, but we're just bringing attention to strategic outputs of the department. And then we talk about trade agreements, implementation in that, and to participate in trade negotiations. That is a huge component of our international work that we do. But it's also one of the areas where we have taken up the opportunity to deploy 12 young economists to get training through the WTO structures to be able to replace the older folks who are driving the trade negotiations for us now. The same applies to the capacity building on market research and market intelligence. The bilateral engagements, that also results in annual reports in terms of how well we have done. We have particular focus on Africa and multinational agencies. And the next one refers to CADA, and apologies for those mistakes in the last indicator. It should just say CADA investment plan approved and launched, and not what sites there, I think. Nation Lounge launched. It is in the cabinet system now. The CADAP invest plan, and so when it is approved, it will probably be launched by the president, because it's a commitment which the president made at Malabo last year in June. Because then we can start a new cycle of consultation with the partners who will sign the compact with us. I think that the last set of indicators on goal 2 on increasing production, employment and economic growth can be found on page 54 and 55 of our APP, and it refers to the number of commodity-based cooperatives supported, and where it's also under 20 every year, And then there are the number of cooperatives supported by training, and why we are able, it's because we're, it's where we are specific in terms of the different levels of support. So I think the first point is we will assist with establishing new cooperatives. So those are new groups of cooperatives that could come into a market, and the cooperative could comprise 300 farmers. It could comprise 20 farmers. And then the next one says, this is the support that we will give to existing cooperatives. It might be a cooperative that is active in a particular value chain that needs training to be able to take them to a different level of competitiveness. The annual report on the transfer, the implementation of the Agri-BEE sector code, I think that becomes a useful level of measuring the, how successful we are in transforming, because the baseline would be available, and the same will be with the forestry sector. Chair, the next set of objectives pertains to strategic goal 3, creating an enabling environment for food security and sector transformation. The first is on this national policy on food and nutrition security, which was approved, that is our baseline, and a very important structure, as I said earlier, is this, the implementation forum that oversees the technical forum that we have with departments that oversees the implementation of the National Food and Nutrition Security Policy. In the AG made reference to the DAF only has 120 hectares in our business plan, and the target according to the NDP is 120, is 1 million, and 120 per annum is not going to take us to 1 million, nor is the 40,000 households that we are going to target, nor is the 1,600 smallholders which we will establish and support. But that is where this forum becomes important, because that is the place where we are able to collect the information and understand and bring forward the support which other government departments is doing to demonstrate that as the whole of government, we will achieve this target of 1 million of whatever. Because as I've also said, APAC is not just an agriculture intervention. It belongs to the whole of the sector. Then the other area on food security, slide 40, and that information is indicators on fishing, on fisheries, can be found in page 70 of our APT, and it's on the implementation of the small-scale fisheries policy. I believe this was presented in detail to the committee last week, and we state there what our targets are for every year. The committee will know that there's a detailed plan for the next 18 months on track, the fishing rights allocation process. And the next slide, slide 41, talks about the capacity building. The first one is on education and training strategy for the sector that we will implement. The next one about the extension, the national extension policy on extension and advisory services, is also a document that we have brought to the committee. We believe that that it should become a national policy. So at this level, at the strategic level, we think it will, our aim is it to be a policy for the whole of government, because many government departments use extension workers. Part of the capacity building of our extensionists is also to deploy them to commodity groups for specialist training and to bring them back into the sector. The last indicator for that area pertains, and this is a very exciting piece of work, Chair, and this is the policy on comprehensive producer support. What we have finished in this year, 2014-15, on norms and standards. It's a punitive work where rural development, land bank, Tax South Africa, EBS, DTI have come together and said, what is your typology? Because everybody has different names for farmers and different criteria, and we've proposed norms and standards for these are the criteria for each category of farmer, and at some point we want that also to be a policy that the whole of government will respond to farmers supporting the same, but more importantly, that farmers and people who are entering the sector or in the sector know which services they can get from which section in government. That is where we must take that to. The last goal, Chair, is on the sustainable use of natural resources in the sector. The first two, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 indicators refers to the forestry and irrigation goals, and that can be found on page 43. What you will see, for example, on the first one, on our audited baseline on temporary unplanted areas, our audited baseline there was 2,005 hectares, but for the coming year, we are only targeting 1,725 hectares, but committee members will also remember the AG or the FSC would say the forestry was the one area where the budget was cut, and therefore the immediate effect of that is the number of hectares that we are able to put under production. We have noted, Chair, the findings by the AG that we must be more specific in our section E on because we thought, I mean, there's just one forestry steward council, and therefore we say they certify a forest, it is by their criteria, but we'll make that more explicit in our APP, the annex to E. The irrigation schemes, I think there was something mentioned there as well. This is an area that is going to require some work because there's a huge gap between the NDP target on the number of hectares under production and what we are saying here. And so there's a whole contention between the scientists about the land that is available for irrigation, the water that is available for irrigation, and what is stated in the NDP. But I think we can initiate that discussion in our cluster at the technical level and take it to a different level if it's not resolved. An important one for us is on the next slide, Chair, the promulgation and development of Agricultural and Development Land Act. I think that it should not take that long. I don't know why we have been so generous with ourselves. I guess that's how the wind usually grinds, but I think we have to work a lot faster with having that act promulgated. Because what that act endeavors to do is to designate agricultural land. Because it cannot be that agricultural land gets alienated from the sector under our watch. Because right now there's land in the hands of municipalities, etc., and unless we urgently designate and certify agricultural land, that bleeding of an asset, and once it is alienated, we cannot recover. But that's an important unit of work. That's a new unit of work that we're quite excited about. The next slide 45, talks to you. Many of these targets, Chair, will be seen under the marine living resources as well. We've noted what the AG says with regard to the compliance issues. When the AU says we are not specific about the compliance, we argue. We enforce compliance with the conditions of the rights. And we cannot predetermine how many people will poach, how many people will overcatch, how many people will have too many crew on their ships. So you don't know what is going to happen. And so you can't disaggregate any further than this, but we will continue to talk and see how we can make it more measurable, because we do want our targets to be smart to the ultimate. And on page 45, those targets can be found on page 63 and 69 of the APP. Chair, the next few slides just speaks about our posts levels, talks about the number of funded posts for the department. We're just short of 7,000, and the number of additional posts to the establishment. That's always, I think the intention is always to reduce and keep that number as low as possible and integrate those colleagues into the mainstream. The next slide speaks to is this a duplicate of the same slide? The budget issues out. My CFO is here. Chair, we have had a presentation of our budget, and if you allow me, I can ask our CFO to just take you through it. I don't think that we have any convergence with difference with what the AG has talked about, but something that we haven't put in here, Chair, and I've got a few slides to that effect, is to break this budget up according to strategic objectives, and we have got that information. And somewhere, I think that what I do know is that the greatest share of our budget is devoted to strategic objective, strategic goal 2, 3, the one on food security. It's about 41% of our budget. And the next one on strategic goal 2 on agricultural production gets the next share of our budget. I do have a breakdown of the budget according to strategic objectives, if you will allow me to circulate it. But if I can ask the CFO to talk to the budget.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DM, DG, honorable members and colleagues. On slide 50, we have the budget as of 2014-15, which is the current year, against the next 3 years, which is 2015-16 to 2017-18. In the 2015-16 year, we've got a budget of 6.3 billion. 729 million goes to administration, 2.1 billion goes to agricultural production, health and food safety, and then 1.9 billion goes to food security and agrarian reform, and then trade promotion and market access is 239 million. Forestry and natural resource management is 906 million, and then fisheries is 443 million. And then if I look at that per economic classification for 2015-16 on slide 51, compensation of employees is at 1.7 billion, and then goods and services is at 846 million, and then interest and rent on land is just 1 million, and then transfers and subsidies are at 3.7 billion, payments for capital assets is at 96 million. Then turning to page 52, the next slide, it's we are looking at the budget per program. What I would do, I would refer to slide 52, where we've got the breakdown for compensation of employees at 391 million, and then goods and services is 309 million, and then transfers and subsidies is 17 million, and then payments for capital assets is 10 million, which accounts for that 729 million. And then going to program two, on slide 54, we've got a budget of 2.1 billion, which is made up of inspection and laboratory service of 321 million, and then there's plant production and health of 549 million, animal production and health at 456 million, and agricultural research at 803. I must say, Chair, I'm just looking at 2015-16. And then the next page is the breakdown per economic classification. I'll skip that slide. And then come to program three, under food security and agrarian reform. The bulk of the money goes to food security, 1.2 billion. And then we've got 255 million for sector capacity development. And then 373 for national extension support services. And then going to slide 58, it's trade promotion and market access. For international relations and trade, we've got 112 million. For cooperatives and rural business development, we've got 68 million. And then for agro processing and marketing, we've got 54 million. And then for program five, which is forestry and natural resource management, on slide 60, we've got a budget of 906 million, 469 million goes to forestry operation, 55 million goes to forestry regulation and oversight, and then 375 goes to natural resource management. Then the last program on slide 62, that would be fisheries. We've got 32 million for aquaculture, monitoring, control and surveillance, 72 million, marine resource management, 19 million, fisheries research and development, 57 million, and then the fund itself, 258 million, which make up the budget for 443 million for fisheries. And then maybe just to highlight on page 63, for the bulk of the money that is under fisheries goes to transfers and subsidies for the management of vessels, and then the other one is for compensation of employees. I thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The time is 10 past 1. We'll break for lunch, 10 past 2. Then we'll engage with the report. Thank you. You can go for lunch.